Sheila Fala. Welcome to Ideas and Issues. On our program this morning, I'll be talking with Jamal Elias, professor of religion at Amherst College, and our topic is Islam. Professor Elias, glad to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
In all candor, I don't know that much about Islam. There are not a lot of Islamic people in this area, and I'm sure the same is true of most of my listeners. So I think it'd be helpful to begin by discussing a little bit, give us some information about the life and writings of the Prophet Muhammad as the beginner of Islam.
Okay, I'd be delighted to do that. Well, in terms of talking about Islam, probably a good place to start is with the Prophet Muhammad. I suppose, like with everyone else, a good place to start in his life is his birth. He was born in what's now Saudi Arabia in approximately 570, perhaps 572 of this era. And key things to know about him were that he came from, he was freeborn from a fairly prestigious family, meaning he wasn't a slave, as many people in those days tended to be. And he was orphaned when he was very young, which seems to have left a lasting impact on him because he held a very special, tender spot for orphans and otherwise sort of socially handicapped people for the rest of his life. After that, he grew up to be a merchant and worked as a merchant from around 20 years of age till about 40 when his prophetic career began, and from the age of 40 until he died in 632, so at the age of approximately 62 years, he received revelations on an irregular basis, so they weren't on a schedule for that latter period of his life, and these revelations were later put together sort of shortly after his death into the Quran. Other things about his life, which I think are very important to know about, are probably his first marriage to a wealthy merchant, a widow who was involved in trade, named Khadija, who was also the first convert to Islam and the mother of Muhammad's four daughters, the only children he had who survived into adulthood. And then later on, he married a woman named Aisha, who was the daughter of a very close companion of his, and Aisha has outlived him by many years, several decades actually, and was one of the most influential people in the early Islamic period and has left a lasting impact on Islamic scholarship and law and things like that. So I guess that's the main event in his life.
Could you tell us a little bit about the religious environment in which he might have grown up and in which Islam then emerged?
I know very little about Arabia at the time of Muhammad. It was, compared to the areas around it, was a cultural backwater, more or less. It wasn't obviously completely cut off from everyone, but to its north there was the Byzantine Empire, the Persian Empire of the Sassanids, to the south there was Abyssinia. All these areas were extremely powerful and well-developed sort of empires and civilizations, and Arabia sort of is located in the middle. And was not unified and didn't have, so in that sense, didn't have an organized church of any kind and didn't have much writing that survived or much architecture that survived. But as far as we know, there was a very small presence of Christians in Arabia at that time, although they generally, they probably belonged to churches that are now considered or were considered by the Orthodox Church and by the Catholic Church as heresies. Of course, they had no organized presence. There were perhaps a few more Jews in Arabia who had migrated there sometime after the destruction of the Second Temple. And again, we don't know actually how many that were there. It's actually reasonably clear that the Torah, as we have it today in written form, was not available to anyone in the Arabian Peninsula. So the vast majority of people actually didn't adhere to any religion that we are familiar with today. They tended to be have a sort of an informal system of devotion to their ancestors or to various forms of sort of nature deities or, you know, phenomena of nature or particular. So they essentially perform rituals around certain stones or trees or things like that. And In addition to that, however, there were pilgrimage sites that they used to visit, and Muhammad's hometown, which is the town of Mecca, has actually had a shrine called Kaaba, which actually means cube in Arabic, and which was the center for major pilgrimage. Muhammad's clan, in fact, was responsible at some level for the custodial duties attached to this Kaaba, to this cubic shrine. And that shrine, incidentally, has since become the geographical focal point of the Islamic world. It's the direction in which Muslims pray, wherever they happen to be, and it's the direction in which, when you're buried, your head faces that direction, etc. It's also the focal point of the major annual pilgrimage that Muslims do.
You indicate that there was not a lot of presence of Christian and Judaic groups in Arabia at the time, and yet Islam has certain connections with both of those religions, and there are even connections which Muhammad himself saw, as I understand. Could you elaborate on what those connections are?
Well, Islam is very closely related to both Judaism and Christianity in the sense that they come from the same sort of tradition of belief in prophecy and one and in a unique, all-powerful God that is deeply involved at an intimate level in human life. So, like Judaism and Christianity, Muslims and Muhammad believed in a chain of prophets beginning with Adam and including all the prophets mentioned in the Hebrew Bible and Jesus, in the case of Muslims, and finally culminating in Muhammad. And this is essentially a chain of people that God designates as his representatives on earth to take his message to humanity. And in that sense, the general Islamic notion of how these religions relate to each other is that God has an eternal message of how he wants human beings to behave and conduct their lives in this world, which he sends down through these people. And this message is one, and it's eternal and identical depending on when it's revealed. But because society, at least this is how most Muslims understand it, because society at any given point in history is only ready to receive a certain portion of the message, in the sense that we can think of it almost as sort of an evolutionary notion of society and spirituality, so that at each given moment, God only reveals what the people could handle right then, and maybe it will push them a little further, and then further on down the line, God reveals a more detailed version. And so on and so forth. And that's how they actually would view the relationship of Judaism and Christianity and Islam as the same divine message but revealed at three different points in history.
So there is this connection. Muhammad has this series of revelations. He's sort of the last prophet. He has these series of revelations. And then after his death, what happens? How does the religion really begin to take hold, and how are these early years important in shaping the current look?
An interesting thing about Muhammad, which particularly for Christian listeners, he'd sound very different to Jesus as a religious leader, is that Muhammad was also not just a prophet, but also the ruler of his community, and in that sense, he's much easier to understand if he's looked at in the same light as Hebrew prophets, perhaps like Solomon or David to some degree, although he never used the title of king and actually didn't like that title, or perhaps even Moses in the sense that he was formerly the leader of his people. So it's very interesting that when Muhammad dies, he doesn't designate a successor, at least not to with a degree of divinity that everyone would agree or people would not disagree on his candidate. So the end result is that after he died, there was quite a bit of disagreement in the early Islamic community about who his successor should be. And several different camps formed. The two major camps, one were the people who felt that his descendants, through his daughter Fatima and her husband Ali, should be the rulers of the Muslim community. And another group which felt that it didn't quite matter who it was, as long as the person was competent and held the community together. And these two In actual fact, early on, it's quite clear that this was a political disagreement. But over time, this disagreement became so formalized that it took on religious and theological connotations, and people had theological reasons as to why Muhammad's descendants should be the rulers of the Islamic world and its religious leaders. And another group had their own reasons as to why this other group, who was not necessarily related to Muhammad, would be the leaders of the community. And in fact, that's the major split in sort of along sectarian lines between the two major Muslim groups, that of the Sunnis, who represent the vast majority and are the people who don't believe in hereditary descent in Muhammad's family, and the second major sectarian group being the Shi'is, or sometimes called Shias or Shiites, who do believe in hereditary descent.
A moment ago you said that after Muhammad's death that his prophecies were written down in the Quran. Is that the main content of the Quran? I mean, unlike the Christian Bible that presumably has any number of authors, is the Quran different in that sense, among others?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's one sense in which it's very different. It actually reads completely differently in the sense that it doesn't read like a book in a narrative sense. It doesn't have a story or a set of stories the way, say, the four Gospels, you know, each it has a narrative that flows through in one nice story. The Quran consists of what are called surahs, which in English are normally translated as chapters. And it has 114 chapters, and the chapters are not related one to the other. They're just sort of organized together, and each, actually some of the longer ones, they seem to be composed of smaller parts, in the sense that none of them is one long story running from beginning to end. And they tend to be much more, some of them are very short, a few lines at the most. These are his earliest revelations, which were very poetic and very powerful, and I presume were designed to attract people to this new religion. And they tend to really remind people of God's greatness and generosity and such things, and also remind them to behave properly and scare them regarding the fact that there's an afterlife in which they'll be judged. And then they tend to be longer ones, which bring up issues of law and society and ethics. But again, in a way that's very different structurally from the Christian Bible, in the sense that, with very few exceptions, there really aren't any stories per se. But as you said, one of the important things to bear in mind is that for Muslims, the entirety of this text, as far as they're concerned, all of it, is believed to be a direct revelation from God to Muhammad, and in the sense that Muhammad doesn't actually author it in any way. He doesn't change anything. He doesn't add any of his own words. He just sort of faithfully passes it on to humanity. That's a cardinal point of belief for the vast majority of Muslims.
Okay, and now what happens is the Quran then takes on a very central role, both in the religion of Islam and in the practice of Islam as being part of or related to the governance of the state, correct?
It does to a degree. I mean, I would argue actually that you know, in the Middle Ages or in the 17th century, it was no different in that regard from Christianity in Europe. So yes, it has some relationship to the state, but it doesn't successfully take over. I mean, kings tend to rule with their own interests in mind and not really religious and ethical things.
Okay, so that may in part be a certain misconception that Westerner, many Westerners may have of Islam.
It is, and I mean, but on the other hand, there's a reason for that. That one of the things that Muslims actually pride themselves on having in their religion is a religious system which has laws which govern every aspect of life, not just sort of overtly religious issues such as how one prays and how one buries one's dead, etc., but also governing things like how one brushes one's teeth, issues regarding, you know, everyday ethics, how you deal with the poor, how much you give in charity, things like that. So Muslims do actually like to believe that Islam governs every aspect of their lives. And if it does, then it's logical to say that it would govern political aspects of one's life, too. So in that sense, it's not a misconception. What is a misconception, perhaps, is the image one gets of it being this extremely tightly organized authoritarian legal system in which it really tells everyone exactly what to do all the time. Because, for one thing, like in other societies, in Islamic societies, and there are many, many different ones, people are fairly likely to ignore the law, be it religious or civil. And also, like in other societies, the law doesn't quite intrude in people's lives all the time. I mean, people tend to live fairly far away from the government.
So the idea that there is this tight connection between the teachings in the Quran, between one's religion and the state, is in part a misconception. And at least part of the reason it's a misconception is because the average citizen, even the devout believer, may not be always guided specifically by the teachings of their religion or by the state.
So, yeah, not at all. They wouldn't be.
Now, suppose, though, that someone did want to see themselves as striving to guide their lives by the teaching of the Quran, and they're trying to understand what the Quran expects of them, what God expects of them. Are there problems with interpreting what the Quran says that come up? And if so, how are those disagreements or questions resolved?
Well, there are several different ways. One of the ways, I mean, to answer your first question, are there problems? Of course, there are always problems with interpretation. And they get resolved in different ways. One of the things is that there are people who are trained, there's scholars or theologians, who are trained precisely in the task of interpreting scripture, and sort of there's a very complex way based on, there's an enormous amount of secondary literature in Islam, dealing with secondary literature meaning things other than the Quran, other than scripture, sort of sayings attributed to the Prophet Muhammad, sayings attributed to other sort of highly respected early Muslims, the scholarship of people for hundreds and hundreds of years, and all of this sort of is put together so that there are scholars to this day who will look at this material and try and interpret to the best of their ability sort of the more obscure points that they find in the Quran. In addition to that, the average person, and the way it often works out is that the average person doesn't resort to asking a qualified theologian sitting in some big office somewhere what precisely they should do. Like they would here, they tend to have a well-formed, but I think generally informal notion of what their religion is and what's right and what's wrong and what's moral. And that's formed, obviously, by having listened to people, having listened to sermons, perhaps, having read religious writings, the education they get from their family and from their environment and so on. So, there's this constant sort of process of interpretation that's going on, and it never stops.
To that extent, then, would you say that the practice of Islam by the average person would not be at all unlike the practice of Judaism or Christianity? What I mean by that, obviously, there are details, but the average Christian, the average Jewish person, is not going to be spending enormous amounts of time trying to look at the Bible or the Torah themselves. In large part, they're going to be basing their actions on the teaching of their parents, of their local rabbi or minister. Would it be similar, at least in that degree, in Islam?
Yeah, it would be. The big difference is that I think also it's in the, on the one hand, to agree with you, yes, I think it's remarkably similar. And also, in as much as people do read their scripture, be it the Torah or be it the Bible, the New Testament, or the Quran, I think Muslims, like the majority of Christians and Jews, do in fact read their scripture, or like a lot of Christians and Jews, do read their scripture, but more as an act of devotion or prayer than in sort of consciously trying to find a religious guidance in a very formal sense. So they do, a lot of Muslims, I wouldn't say the majority, but a lot of Muslims do in fact try and read the Quran or a little bit of the Quran on a regular basis. But I think it's more sort of an act of religious devotion and inspiration.
Could you elaborate exactly what you mean by reading it as a matter of devotion or religious inspiration rather than looking for a particular answer?
Well, I mean in the sense that maybe to give an example, an example would be if the difference between someone trying to find the answer to a problem, a legal problem or religious problem in their life, in the case of a Muslim, let's say, they want to find out whether or not they can eat a particular thing, meaning Islam has dietary laws, and whether or not a particular thing is forbidden by dietary law. So for them to go to the book and then try and find the answer to this, they're unlikely to do that. However, they are likely, and in fact many people do, on a daily basis or once a week or whenever they can, they will sit down and read a portion of scripture and perhaps reflect on it and think about what it's saying to them. And in that they do get a message and sort of reconfirm their attachment to their religion, but it's done, I think, in an emotional, informal way rather than sort of a legal kind of way. Is that clear? Does it make any sense?
Yes, no. In fact, I'm wondering if another way of putting it is it's part of a religious ritual which is supposed to cement one's religious attachments, beliefs, faith, however you want to describe it, much in the way that other rituals might be. Is that?
I think so, yeah. I'd agree with you.
Okay. In fact, maybe you could help us too by talking a little bit about the sorts of rituals that might identify Islam.
Well, the most important rituals, and again, I'd have to emphasize that, you know, there are approximately a billion Muslims in the world today, and they live in I don't know how many countries. Essentially, there are Muslim established Muslim populations in every inhabited continent of the planet. So, anything I say doesn't quite hold true for everybody, but the majority of Muslims sort of do believe that there are certain ritual requirements that they're supposed to engage in, and although a lot of them might not do them or not do them with any regularity, they do believe that these are the rituals of their religion. And Muslims are supposed to pray in a set prescribed fashion five times a day at set times of the day. They're supposed to fast, which means not eating or drinking, from before sunup till after sundown for an entire month. It's a month called Ramadan, which passed a couple of months ago here. Then they are supposed to give a certain percentage of their wealth in charity every year. They're supposed to once in their lifetime, if they can, make a pilgrimage to the Kaaba, the central shrine of Islam located in Mecca in Saudi Arabia. And then the basis of all this for a lot of Muslims, what they'll say is the first thing they're supposed to do is to profess that God is one and that Muhammad is his messenger. So these are essentially the ritual requirements of the religion as most Muslims understand them.
This is Ideas and Issues. My guest this morning is Jamal Elias, professor of religion at Amherst College, and we are discussing Islam. What I'd like to do in the last part of the show is basically two different questions. The first one is, if you were going to identify what you see as the central misconceptions of Islam, and again, we're speaking in generalities here. Obviously, not everyone has the same misconceptions, but if you want to speak in a general way about the kinds of misconceptions, images of Islam that come out of the press, perhaps that show up in movies, television shows, what would those misconceptions be?
Well, I think one that I feel, and I know a lot of other Muslims find very problematic, is that the general, that there's a conception that people have, or certainly the media seems to want to portray, of Muslims as being fundamentally violent. And at some level, the religion of being violent. And in that sense, the certain stereotypes regarding the treatment of women fit into this notion of sort of a bunch of angry, violent men running around trying to take advantage of everyone else, which I think is one that I'd like to try and undo. again, as I said, the, you know, the Islamic world is huge and very, very different. When one thinks about the fact that the vast majority of Muslims live east of the River Indus, meaning, you know, that the Indus is runs down the middle of Pakistan, which is not even in the Middle East anymore. We're talking about South Asia. So the most populous, you know, most Muslims live in Indonesia, then in you know, India, Bangladesh, Pakistan. These are the population centers of the Islamic world. Then, you know, Turkey, Iran, all these are sort of, it's Nigeria. We're talking about people, sort of the stereotype of what a Muslim is like or looks like is not at all true. The average Muslim is probably female and 14 years old and living in Indonesia or in Bangladesh. So the stereotype is so different from what life is like. And even for those people who do perhaps look, you know, who are male and swarthy and perhaps to some people fierce-looking, they too, by and large, are concerned with exactly the same things that other people in the world are concerned with, paying their bills, making sure their family's okay, going to the movies. I mean, it's... So in that sense, this notion that they're somehow different and behave differently has always struck me as perhaps an unfair stereotype.
Now let's turn it the other way. If you were going to identify what you see as the central contributions of Islam to the world, what would they be? What is it that makes Islam unique as a religion?
Well, it's tough for me to say what contributions of religions are beyond sort of the fact that they. I mean, my personal feeling would be that, you know, religions sort of influence societies and societies make contributions. But I think, well, Islam's contributions, well, let's put it this way, Islam, because of Islam, Arabic, which is a very interesting language, is spoken in, you know, 20-some countries of the world. It started out in one little, in what's now Saudi Arabia, that's one. Islam sort of became the religion of a very large piece of land, which stretched from essentially... at one point in time from central India to the Atlantic Ocean. There were sort of many political institutions and social institutions across that world which were patronized by people who believed in this religion and particularly in the sciences and in philosophy, so that a lot of Islamic philosophers and mathematicians and scientists and astronomers have had a direct impact on the development of sciences in Europe. In fact, much of what the European world eventually learned about the Greeks, the ancient Greeks, about philosophy and medicine, they actually learned it by translating the Arabic translations of the Greek works. Because the Muslims, when Islam originally spread, they essentially swallowed ancient Greek civilization and all its writings and its knowledge, just hook, line, and sinker, and just appropriated them and made it part of their own. So in that sense, that's another thing they tend to share very strongly with European civilization. And it was through this channel of Islamic civilization that stuff made it to Europe. So I think that's a major contribution. The word algebra is Arabic. The zero was discovered by a Muslim. I mean, you know, there are things like that.
Well, I want to thank you very much for appearing on the show today. It's been quite enlightening talking to you.
Well, thank you. It's been a pleasure, and I hope it's been helpful.
I've been speaking today with Jamal Elias, professor of religion at Amherst College. This is Hewlett-Packard for Ideas and Issues. Good day.